if I told you where I was going. It wouldn't be a holiday.
Welcome to Mission Impossible Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, I'm at Falcon Screen. That was the tune from, hands down, the worst Mission Impossible film, Mission Impossible 2, filmed right here.
We'll see about that.
We'll see about that, because we'll be fighting about that later in the program, as we will be Mission Impossible 6, which is in cinemas tomorrow, Fallout.
The fallout from this discussion is going to be intense.
They should have just called it Mission Impossible 6, though, right? Like, who cares about these dumb titles?
No, but then everyone would call it MI6, which would be, like, weird.
Oh, yeah, that's a very... But perfectly appropriate, right?
Yeah, perfectly. But MI5 would have been the same problem, which is why they called it Rogue Nation. Anyway, we will be talking about that later in the program. Should I just introduce who we have on the panel? Virat Nehru, a creative writer, film... critic for films. Sorry, I'm screwed up terribly. And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans. I just fused those introductions together.
It works.
But we are creative people.
But first up, we are talking about... It's festival season, and the Korean Film Festival in Australia is hitting our cinemas in Sydney from the 8th of August through to the 19th. And we have with us to discuss this year's festival program, David Park, the director of the festival. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So we're ready to talk about the festival, but before we get into some individual films, can you tell us about the festival? What is its aims? What is it going for? And what are the types of films you are showing this year?
So basically, this is our 9th year down under, and this year we're in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Canberra. I guess our festival just aims to, introduce as many diverse genres of Korean film as possible to the domestic audience here in Australia. And as mentioned, we've been doing this for about 9 years, and the support is continually growing each year, which is great to see.
Wonderful. Now, I'm going to arrange my tickets, but one film I'm particularly interested in seeing is Gunjam Haunted Asylum. Now, we've talked about different types of approaches to filmmaking on the show and how there's films like Chronicle, where it's from the POV of a filmmaker or amateur filmmaker, and this seems very much along those lines, but it also has a few very different twists about it.
Yeah, I guess it touches on the whole genre that was sparked through the found footage genre, which the Blair Witch Project did so fantastically. I guess this is Korea's attempt at the genre. And I was very interested in, the way the film explored the whole contemporary notion of, live streaming, YouTube, and brought it in so seamlessly into this genre. It's a terrifying film. It's actually a very scary film. It was just executed so well for, a director who has not worked with actors of, of this caliber. I mean, he chose actors who had rarely never acted before, but their reactions are just, amazing.
One of the films I was really interested in is A Taxi Driver. This one sounds like it's touching on a pretty core issue in Korea's history. Could you tell us a little bit about that one for people who aren't familiar with the subject matter?
Yeah, sure. So it's set in the 1980s. And it's based on the story of a taxi driver who usually works in Seoul. One day he hears that there is a foreigner who wants to pay big money for him to take him down to Gwangju City. And Gwangju is located toward the south of the South Korean Peninsula. And once he makes it down there, he realizes that the city is under siege by the military government. And in the backdrop of, the Gwangju Massacre, which was one of the most tragic historical events in, modern Korean history. And it's a very, in the words of Sherry Linden from The Hollywood Reporter, I think she puts it very fantastically. She says it's a richly imagined tribute to a Korean working class hero. It's by the director, Jang Hoon, who has worked very closely with an international a Korean film icon, Kim Gi-duk. Yeah, it's definitely a film to look out for. He doesn't really go into the gore and violence of the massacre, but, you know, it's very emotionally mature and astute.
Would you say that it's similar in style to Kim Ki-duk's approach?
No, actually. And right. I guess one of the biggest reasons that Jang Hoon kind of had a bit of a falling out with Kim Ki-duk was that he did not, I guess, assimilate fully into Kim Ki-duk's style. Mm-hmm. I guess he was trying to raise him up to be his next protege, but he kind of, cast that aside and set about his own style and, you know, seeked out, you know, more mainstream films, topics which resonated more with the mainstream audience.
Yeah, that's interesting because I find Kim Ki-duk can be hard to get into sometimes.
Yeah, that goes for me too. Yeah.
Changing track completely from hard to get into films to very easy to get into films, I wanted to touch upon the sports movie that's playing Champion. And it's got a really interesting twist to it. I mean, usually you find the sports being mentioned and talked about as very grandiose and, you know, the journey seems to be for a very sort of involving sport. But here the person wants to be an arm wrestling champion, which is a very interesting thing to be. So can you tell us a bit about that movie? Because that seems to be a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, I don't think Korea's had a film about arm wrestling. And to be honest, it's not a very easy topic to cover in a filmic sense. I mean, it's, I think there's a very narrow scope to work with when you're just having this story about an arm wrestler. But the reason why the film was very popular domestically was because of the main starring actor, who I guess goes by his English name is Don Ma, and he is actually very renowned for having a very big physique. So he's kind of, I guess, like the Dwayne Johnson of Korea. And for him to come out in this film, which boasts his, I think his biceps are about 22 inches.
Oh, okay.
All right. Yep.
Glenn is a huge, to give you context, Glenn is a huge Dwayne Johnson fan. So you just pissed right all over him right now.
We want to team these guys up, definitely.
So, I mean, yeah, there were actually talks of when Dwayne Johnson was in Asia doing his press tour, I think it was for Rampage or Skyscraper. There was actually talks of getting these two together to have like an arm wrestling match. Well, obviously, it didn't come to fruition. It would have been really awesome to have seen something like that. But so this guy, he has his 22-inch arms. I mean, and that's, I guess, is the main selling point of this film. But the director, Kim Young-wan, actually goes a lot deeper into the identity of, I guess, Koreans raised overseas. Because the main character, played by Don Lee, Mark, is a Korean immigrant who was born in the U.S., coming back to Korea to make a name for himself through arm wrestling. So there are a few more dimensions to this whole film compared to just him arm wrestling a few guys and going out to become a champion in the field.
That's really interesting that there's still an aspect of social commentary involved in this and not just an out-and-out, sort of popcorn movie, as they would say.
Yeah, I think it's a very mature approach. And I just feel that, audiences are now looking for more depth in films. Your regular shoot-em-up movies or films that are quite one or two dimensional, it just doesn't resonate as well in the box office, I just feel. And I guess there is a need now for directors to get more creative, to get more in-depth and develop and bring out those characters.
Right. A film that does sound like it goes a bit more in-depth into developed characters, judging by the description at least, is Microhabitat.
Microhabitat.
This, yeah, this one really sounds to me like an American indie type film. And the poster gives the kind of minimalistic, you know, really production designed kind of vibe of that sort of movie as well. But yeah, I was wondering what you could tell us about it.
Yeah, I think it's a great debut. It's a debut film of a director called John Go-woon. Now, John Go-woon is actually part of indie filmmaking production house called Gwanghwa Moon Cinema. Now, they've been quite prominent coming up in the scene since 2014. And it's a group of directors who are friends, and each of them annually release a feature film. And she is... So John Go-woon, I guess, this is her debut film, and it opened at the Busan International Film Festival last year. And it was received very well. I think it was one of the most talked about films of the festival last year. And I just really felt that it was a really great testament to the strength of Korean art house cinema. You know, you've got this very great encapsulating lead character who is a female character. I just feel, you know, we need more films like this, which showcase these amazing characters. We need more women on screen. Mm. And I just really feel that Miso, the main character in this film, is a very lovable character.
Right.
And her journey, I guess, through couch surfing her friends' houses acts as a very big social commentary.
Right. And Jung Go-woon is also a woman behind the camera, and
yes,
she'll also be coming to the festival.
Yes.
Can you tell us?
She will be there for a Q&A, and she will be also joined by the producer of the film.
Can you tell us about some of the other guests coming?
So we have Chang Hang-jun, who is another film director, coming in for a Q&A of his session. And the film that he directed, which is in our program, is called Forgotten. So it's about, a village college student who moves into a new house with his family, and one day his older brother gets kidnapped. Now, the kicker is, after 19 days, the older brother comes back, but he has no recollection or memory whatsoever of his of the time that he was away from his family. And I guess it goes into the main character's mental frame, as he's not, I guess he suffers from schizophrenia, and it's a psychological thriller from there, because everything that the other characters are saying just seems to conflict with memories, and there's a huge twist throughout the film, which just changes the whole dynamics and just flips it on its head.
Sounds good. Are there any other films we haven't mentioned that you might recommend?
I think I'm very proud of our opening film as well. It's called Little Forest. It's a nice film that the whole family can watch. It's about a girl who lives in the city, who moves into the countryside, and she just, you know, delves into the simple life, just growing her own food and just making friends with old, childhood friends who dwelled in that rural neighborhood. And although it feels like there's not a lot going on in the story, it's just beautifully filmed, showcases the whole four seasons of the Korean rural landscape. And it's just one of those films that you can watch lightheartedly and just, come out at the end of the film just feeling refreshed and healed. And I just felt that there weren't many films that kind of had the power that this film had. If anything, I would definitely recommend Little Forest, which is our opening film.
Well, thank you, Dev. Looking forward to it. So the festival's very soon. For people who want to go, where do we go? Where do we seek it out? And how do we get tickets?
Sure. More information can be found on www.kofia.com.au. So that's K-O-F-F-I-A. We are open at the Dendy Cinemas in Opera Keys, so right next to the Opera House. So, you know, it's perfect for a date, perfect for a stroll around the Circular Quay after the film.
Nice views, yeah.
Yep.
Great views.
I'll make sure that I find a date so I can take advantage of the views.
Things just got strangely personal to close out this, this interview.
But Dendy Opera Keys. It's a beautiful location, so we'll definitely, there's a few cinemas down there, so definitely seek it out, and tickets available online, and or we can get them at the box office right there.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Wonderful. Well, David, look, it's been a pleasure. We're looking forward to the festival. Thank you so much, and we're looking forward to seeing some excellent Korean cinema.
Yep, look forward to seeing you guys, and thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll be right back with our review of Mission Impossible 6 Fallout. Stay tuned, if you choose to accept. Okay, I got to admit that that's pretty good.
The theme was cool.
The theme was good. Is that the one saving grace of this film?
No, everything about this movie was very cool.
No, we are talking about that. We were talking about Mission Impossible 2. I don't think there was a subtitle. It was just Mission Impossible 2.
No, back in those days, there weren't subtitles. But since then, they've all sounded like Xbox games. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Mission Impossible. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Rogue Nation. Yeah. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Fallout.
Yeah, we literally
Splinter Cell Fallout.
We don't need a plot. But like, it's kind of like the same with the plotting of this. We don't really need a plot. People want to destroy the world because violence begets better things and whatever. We're not really sure. Just general. We know what the world needs and wants.
Tom Cruise running. That's what the world needs.
Okay, this added an extra at least 15 minutes to the amazing Tom Cruise running supercut.
Yeah.
No, but honestly, I was reading this editorial from Rotten Tomatoes about the extensive running Tom Cruise does in his movies and whether that corresponds to the success of the movies in the box office.
And it does?
Yeah, it does, apparently.
Yeah, apparently it's true.
IndieWire, I saw this. That's pretty hilarious. I mean, look, him running has always been great. Let's admit.
He has a great run.
He has a great run.
It does have a great run.
And as does the series, Mission Impossible 6.
Yes, it has.
Six.
On its 22nd year now.
On its 22nd year.
And 50-something years. 53 years, I think. So it was 51 since the TV show.
Oh, I've never something actually like seen that. Too much of the TV show.
Neither have I.
Look, my introduction.
Look, this isn't TV Fight Club, okay?
This is Film Fight Club.
And call us to complain.
And this is not just a film for me, because Mission Impossible 1 was the first action film I ever saw. So this is pretty special for me. This, however, is Mission Impossible 6 Fallout. It is the first time we have a returning director to the franchise, which is Christopher McQuarrie. And it's
now
stars,
BFFs with Tom Cruise.
Yes. And it stars, of course, Tom as Ethan Hunt, as Ving Rhames returns, Rebecca Ferguson returns from Rogue Nation, Simon Pegg and Alec Baldwin rock up. There's a Henry Cavill with a mustache.
Henry Cavill, Terminator, with a mustache.
He's very good in this.
No, he's such a bad actor. He's such never a cardboard been a bad actor. Cutout.
Oh, sorry, you watch The Tudors. He's Charles Brandon.
I know,
Elgar,
but this
spot
is not
on.
The Tudors. So, this is MI whatever.
People are calling this one of the greatest action movies of all time. That's the early buzz. What do we think?
All right, so first of all, I've got to explain my general view on this series. This series started as an anthology. By that I mean each of them were individual episodes. And then when J.J. Abrams took over, Come Ghost Protocol, they started to resemble
three,
more of a series.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. From 3 onwards, they have continuity, more recurring characters other than Ving Rhames just rocking up.
Yes. But Ghost Protocol, you know, at the end they say there's this thing called the Syndicate, and this is essentially a direct sequel to Rogue Nation. It's starting to go as a series now. I think this is the best film since the first one. It's the fourth time I've said it. I don't like the second one, but I think since the third one, they've gotten progressively better. One of the reasons I like this is that this veers very close to the first one. It is a script for De Palma, but very sadly, I think without the touches of a director as talented as De Palma. I also think it's a problem because they go into way too much comic relief. This film did not need the amount of reprieves it had. The first one, and even the second one for all its faults, was incredibly cool and was okay with being self-serious and self-confident. The others, including this one, had never been, and as good as this is, that is, they are, it is a massive detraction for the series, including Fallout.
But do you want to say something, Chris? Well, first? I'll let you.
Okay, Fallout.
Stake the whatever.
Look, the action is so good, right?
Oh yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, deny that it could be
one of the best action movies ever.
No, it's not. But by virtue just of the triumphant little moments in action scenes, this movie has a lot to recommend it for. The way that the scenes are constructed is great. There's a chase sequence in the middle of the movie where the dynamics of the chase after an interlude in the middle reverse. So we get to see Tom Cruise in one role and then break for tension release and then suddenly the exact opposite of what we've just watched. Fantastically put together, amazing sound design, great location photography. It's pretty much an old school action movie in that the appeal of it is seeing somebody do stunts and globetrotting locations around the world, something that we've lost touch with in the aftermath of, you know, here it comes, Marvel and all the other CG-driven action blockbusters we get these days. Yeah, exactly. And that's a big part of the appeal of this movie. The reason I don't think it's as great as some of the early hype would have you believe is that I don't care about any of the drama between the action scenes. I think it's reasonably well executed. There are some nice little gotcha, aha moments, but the plot line is an assemblage of points from Mission Impossible 3, 4, 5, and 6. Like the villain is doing the same thing that the villain in Ghost Protocol was doing. The climax is very similar to the climax of Ghost Protocol. And number 5. Yeah, 4, especially 4, 5, and 6.
And arguably 2 as well.
Yeah. We're seeing these same kinds of scenarios, the same kinds of villains, the same kinds of concepts.
And even number 3 with the rabbit's foot, it's the same
shit. Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's just that it's been reconfigured in a different way with better action scenes. The action scenes don't have such spectacular gimmicks as we've seen in the past. The Burj Khalifa, I think, in Ghost Protocol will be impossible to top.
It's still a series high. I mean, I like the bullet train in the first one, but the Burj Khalifa, just for the image of Cruise hanging off. And this is half the fun,
comedy.
Seeing Cruise do his own stunts. I have issues with the comedy in the series, and we can get into that later, but I do think the Burj Khalifa is a series high.
I mean, the Burj Khalifa scene, though, is an example of the comedy working. This movie, I think, would be better if it were played a bit more seriously. Khalifa was like watching a Jackie Chan, Buster Keaton kind of thing, you know, the comedy of him sort of falling and hanging on to things. In this movie, the action's played pretty much straight and serious, but it's a bit too much action, honestly, or maybe it's too much action for having characters that I don't care about that much. The final action stretch is fantastic, but in the lead up,
so good.
But in the lead up to that, I checked my clock and I was thinking, hang on, this feels like it should be ready to end, not have like 40, 50 more minutes to go.
It's interesting because I've been wondering or at least trying to think about what makes a good action movie. Like, is the action enough to make it a good action movie? If I do get to see original action pieces, is that enough in terms of my value for money, or do I need more out of it? And do I need a good dramatic kind of setup to actually sustain me throughout that sort of thing? And like, if you think about it, like, let's say, hark back to Logan and stuff, where this is where action movies are going, where things are starting to be all about, you know, mushy-mushy and less of action and more of the dramatic stakes.
Yeah, I think it depends.
But in that sense, it's an old-school thing. Yeah, but also what I do like, and I agree with Chris, is that we got to see real action in this movie. Like, you know, I could feel the tension in the cinema hall. I could see Glenn's face contort in many different ways, which I haven't seen physically contort. It was possible when Cruise was falling off places and hurting his ankle and breaking his bones, literally, in this case. So it was actually good to see, you know, in that sense, which felt real. It felt immediate, and that sort of detachment was drawn away from this movie. But at the same time, let's talk about the acting and the actual sort of dramatic stakes, and I felt that was a real letdown. Cavill. There we go.
August Walker.
Yeah. Oh God.
What a name.
Yeah. What a.
He was just, you know, he was just December throughout this movie. So cold, and you know, no expression on his face.
What about Rebecca Ferguson? Though, I mean, I'll give you Alec Baldwin and Simon Pegg, who are big bugbears about this series.
And
Ferguson
Rames,
was
like every no. Rebecca Ferguson was Vanessa Kirby was the best thing. About
oh yeah,
this
movie. She had a very elegant hark back to the first film, One of Many. She is one of the best things about this. We don't want to ruin the what it is, but it's very, very fun.
With what Virat was saying about whether, you know, whether these actors are good or not in the scenes between matters or not, I think it does if you make it a focus of the movie. I think you can make a great movie that's almost entirely action, like Mad Max Fury Road, but which has less drama stuff between the action sequences. But in doing so, the drama and minimalistic character development in that movie, I think, is way more affecting than anything in Mission Impossible Fallout. And I make that comparison because a lot of critics are comparing it in terms of being a relentless action movie, constant chases, to that. I think, yeah, the problem is that whenever the action scenes are going on, you do, as Virat said, feel the tension. There are great little moments of, will he make it through this? Will he not? Are they going to pull through, where you're really engaged? And then it gets back to the script level, people standing around and double-crossing each other and whatever, and it's like, been there, done that. I think that stuff just isn't that well executed. Like, the action, as I said, doesn't have maybe as interesting gimmicks if you were to describe what the action scenes are compared to the previous films, but it's just so well executed. But on the other hand, the drama goes to such crazy lengths, but in terms of the complexity of it and the double crosses, and but comparing it to Mission Impossible 1, which is entirely driven by those sorts of espionage confrontations and is much more simpler but way better pulled off, I think Christopher McQuarrie doesn't really exhibit any genius for the paranoia and the espionage drama side of this these movies.
Yeah, I do agree with that. There's a couple of sequences in this that are identical to the marvelous train sequence where we first meet Luther and the John Renault character in this, that the dialogue and the style, there's a sequence in Paris which is very similar to even John Wick, and has touches of Eyes Wide Shut about it, this fantastical dialogue which worked when Brian De Palma did it. I don't think McQuarrie has the self-confidence to pull it off.
It's pretty flat,
yeah.
Honestly. The You've seen it before.
Yeah. In terms of the action, I'm going to say what I liked about it was that it was nonstop. The second act, by that I mean about an hour, 10 minutes of this film, is about the closest any action film I've ever seen has got to the spy versus spy, double, triple crossing identity dynamic, which is incredible, which is good for two other reasons. Number one, Tom Cruise, seeing him pull all of the stuff. But two, the action scenes are derivative of the plot and the characters, not because we actually need to shoot out now. They tell us a lot about them. The halo jump at the beginning of the second act.
Yeah, that was good.
Tells us all about what we need to know about the dynamics between Cavill and Cruise, which persists.
I agree. That was great. I was getting angry in the cinema.
But lastly, in terms of the tension, I liked that a lot of the times they didn't feel the need to stop and make a joke to break it up. De Palma's film worked because it was just action, action, and action. And if you look at the train sequence, it was a bit of a reprieve when the conductor fell down. It was similar, Chris, I will give you, the Burj Khalifa, when the only comic reprieve was at the end when Simon Pegg walks in. We need that breath. We need that release. Here it was a little bit too much. There's a scene where he's about to jump out a window, and it's great, but then someone says, he says, I'm about to jump out a window, in case, yes, we know it's preposterous. We're not here because
it's Mission Impossible, guys.
Want to see this absurd action. Yeah. So I felt break up the tension in that way was a little bit too much, and it did take away from a lot of the dramatic tension and the action sequences to boot.
The two good things that I do like about this movie is, firstly, it solved its two female lead crisis. You know, with Michelle Monaghan, was just after the third movie, you know, you don't know whether she existed.
She rocks up for a cameo at the end where they're like, we know we said that he was settling down.
So I'm glad.
You know, she's not dead. Don't worry, guys.
I'm glad they solved it because she was a real ghost protocol for the, you know, the second sort of...
The protocol of what do we do with the ghosts of her character.
Yeah, and they pretty much cleared all the important bits of that in the trailer anyway.
Yeah, so I'm glad that, that sort of tension between Rebecca Ferguson and her character solved. And the most importantly is a personal victory. I'm glad that Tom Cruise was the one which solves the crisis in my homeland. I'm not going to give it away. You know, those people know.
They really tiptoe around that. It's actually quite... You'll see how they do it. We do want to talk about this more. We have 1 minute left, and we're going to be talking about this in the podcast in so much more detail.
I want to complain about the trajectory of Ethan Hunt's, inverted commas, character over the course of this series. And this is, you know, if I can sneak in one last comment, man, this guy, he's the savior. That's it. He has no character except that he's the noblest, most pure guy ever to get involved in international espionage. That's it.
And we will be talking...
And he does impossible things.
And we will talk more about all the impossible things Ethan Hunt has done on the podcast. Join us next week,
however, keeping his moral compass.
In Melbourne for the Melbourne International Film Festival. We'll be covering so many films at MIFF, which we'll be reading cinemas anytime soon. So please do tune in. And also subscribe to the podcast where we're talking Mission Impossible. If you choose to download it. It will not self-destruct, we promise.
This episode will in...
We should have started 10 seconds. Now, it's self-destruct in 10, 9, 8. It won't really self-destruct. 7, 6, it's going to be okay. 5, 4. Glenn Falcon said, Chris Evans, you have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies.
It wouldn't be a holiday.
Good night. And this is the Film Fight Club podcast talking about Mission Impossible with our superstar. They always get a little more creative with how they do the, you know, this is your mission if you choose to accept it.
I did appreciate the very sort of Iliad and Odyssey kind of reference.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of
oh, that was so over the top.
No, it is better than, you know, receiving black sunglasses when you're climbing up.
No, nothing will ever be better than the black sunglasses being shot out of a cannon.
onto Utah. Like, what was that whole film?
Why didn't they just hand him the sunglasses?
Yeah, the one film that puts Brighton Les Sands and La Perouse on the map is such a bad one. Oh my God. There's almost nothing redeeming about that film.
The trajectory of this series is, I disagree with that in a big way, but the trajectory of this series is a really strange one. You go back and you watch Mission Impossible 1 and it reminds you how much we've lost in big budget filmmaking. Because yeah, it's, you know,
it's so good. It's still so bloody
it's
good.
It's so smart compared to anything that would be hitting cinemas today. Like, it's so clearly aimed at adults, right?
And also,
there's no, like, 12-year-olds are okay with this protection in it.
And just the idea of how you set up action pieces and, like, how do you set up tension within those action set pieces? I mean, it only has about two or three.
That's right. It only really
ones.
Has two
yeah.
action scenes
and
one
yet,
sort of suspense scene.
You remember both of them very clearly.
Yeah. That's everyone right. knows Tom Cruise falling to the floor and suspending himself. Everyone
which
remembers.
Which is a trademark from the TV show, I believe. Always having scenes where yeah. people get lowered from the ceiling. Yeah.
And the bullet
two
train.
Does it.
Hashtag shout out to Doom 2, which copied that sequence, and many others from Mission Impossible series. But anyway.
But, yeah. but can we talk about how that worked so well? It was the most effective action noir, and there aren't a lot of noir that are predominantly action films.
I mean, but the film, it isn't really, by today's standards, predominantly an action film. I would call it a suspense thriller, an espionage thriller.
Back
which,
then it was an action
but
film.
But back then it was an action film. As I said, it just shows you how much we've lost.
Yeah, now we need, that, not that I'm objecting to the second act of this film, but you need an hour plus of just nonstop
yeah,
action like in Mission
a
Impossible
A movie
6.
Like this would never get made and sold on the scale that Mission Impossible was back then.
No, but then Tom Cruise wasn't the... Although he was the entity somewhat back
yeah,
in Top
that's
Gun,
the, thing.
The Look, firm.
Looking at movies like Mission Impossible and Mission Impossible 2, it reminds us of how movies used to be just sold on the actor's name.
And you know, now you have to pack so many... And Alec Baldwin, who should never have been cast yep. in the series, he's so
I think
so
movies
hammy.
Today need to be so much more high concept in a way that's divorced from the star. Like, you know, it's got to be like Aquaman. He's the man who swims and mermaids and sea creatures. You know, Mission Impossible 2, it's basically, yeah, it's an action movie with Tom Cruise. And people went, whoa, and it was the biggest movie of the year.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they did because it was still bloody fantastic. Look, I saw it last night on TV and I don't watch movies on TV anymore.
Man.
Like, you know, because you just get sick of the ads. But I was like waiting.
The restaurant scene where he has the gum and it explodes and he runs out.
No, that's in Mission Impossible 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. The thing about Mission Impossible 2.
Thank you,
that,
Chris. Talk about the 2.
Yeah, the thing about 2 coming after 1 is it suddenly you can see this movie, this series defining itself by what it's going to be. In a big way. One, it's now no longer an espionage thriller, but a series about Tom Cruise climbing on things, as Ethan Hunt's first appearance in this movie.
Don't
is,
forget the doves.
Yeah, a rock climbing stunt.
He and, also climbs on Thandie Newton, which is...
yes, he does. Yeah. And two, she climbs on him as well.
I know, it's equal opportunity, which is great.
Yeah.
And what, that's the Chimera virus?
Yeah.
Absurd.
But it's an absurd plot. But the second thing that the movie does to distinguish itself from the first one is completely rewrite who Ethan Hunt is. In the first movie, he seemed like not a nice guy. Like, he had good ethics, so you could believe in him as the hero, but he was the kind of person I would believe is an actual spy. Like, he's kind of cynical, and he doesn't trust people, and he's just trying to sort of, you know, get out of this situation alive. Suddenly, the series became Tom Cruise's vanity project, where it's more and more about, as the series goes on, starting with 2, he becomes nicer and nicer, and it becomes more and more about his incorruptible ethics, especially starting with 3.
He becomes a teacher, and then right. he goes after the people who killed his star's pupil, up yeah. by Melissa George, I think.
That's right. He yeah. has no consistency of characterization over the course of this series, and it's reached the point in... It especially, yeah, with 3 starts becoming this shining white knight character. And in 6, we've got a pause for Ving Rhames to deliver a speech about how amazing Tom Cruise's character is. Ving Rhames also has changed quite a lot. He was like the cool icy,
badass hacker man. I just don't know.
In the original,
Know he was the good guy or the bad guy. Yeah. In the second one, he wanted the holiday in Sydney, so everyone rocked
up. He was a cool spy team member who had tech skills. He gave a lot more, showed a lot of personality. Now he's like the lovable team mascot.
So is Benji.
It's all lovable. It's just everything's been Marvelized, where you need to love all the characters and they need to be cute and quippy. We can no longer have a big budget mass audience movie with kind of characters who maybe sometimes reflect the darkness that actual people have.
James Bond is the one exception, and this is nothing like James Bond, except for the extent that he's become this infallible figure.
That Bond went in the opposite direction and made Daniel Craig much darker than Pierce Brosnan had been.
Yeah, it's interesting how Bond is going, actually, like, you know, and they're trying to actually reconcile Bond's annoyingness with some kind of gravity and give him some kind of character, which he has never had in his campy own way. They're making him some kind of real-life person. But in that sense, I think it's the Fast and Furious effect. Everything is about family now.
But more
you don't have characters or people with their own motivations. You just do everything for the family and... It's just...
There's a lot of family and there's a lot of, you know...
I just wanted to kill a lot of family. It felt like I wanted to hate family. Like, you know, the idea of family was just putrid and puerile by the end of it.
This is love song dedications with Virat Nehru.
Richard. He's been off the air since 2013, as I learned the other day, because there was a local play called Love Song Dedications.
I saw that.
Richard Mercer.
That's what planted the idea of him in my mind.
Right, yeah.
Inception. But the whiplash between 1 and 2 is crazy. You go from this really intense movie of close, canted angle close-ups of Tom Cruise looking paranoid and grabbing his temples to Mission Impossible 2.
Richard, you've never seen me very upset. Yeah. All right, Hunt. A great moment.
Exactly.
Great,
but
shot
fantastic.
From below like that. Beautiful.
Yeah, perfect. Mission Impossible 2 is like, the first half, I think, is just really bad. It's just super dumb. Romance that we don't care about, villains that we don't particularly care about. But then the second half, once John Woo cuts loose with the action, is fantastic. The action is so dumb. It's great.
Where they fly off the motorcycles onto
like
each other.
So ridiculously over-stylized, like operatic music and Tom Cruise doing millions of flips and twirls that are totally unnecessary. Dual-wielding guns like Chow Yun-Fat.
Bollywood loves that stuff.
Bollywood does love that stuff. I was thinking about how much Bollywood
stuff I've seen.
No, seriously. The only legacy
of Mission Impossible 2 is that I get to take friends come overseas to La Perouse and say, you know, hey, here's where they filmed Mission Impossible 2. Here's where they filmed The Matrix. It's part of my film tour.
But yeah, even Mission Impossible 2, which was like the huge spectacle at the time, looks so small scale compared to what the series is doing now and what action movies now are in general.
Even 4 to an extent, where they go to India of all places and it's like the slower sequence, which leads to the faster sequence where he's fighting in the car lift.
Right, but it shows creeping in the kind of formula elements of action movies today, where they've got this race against time thing and at the end of 4 to... turn off some missiles before they hit somewhere. You know, we've got to have this like apocalyptic circumstances going on.
Every
this movie has to compete with Superman.
Every film from like 3, 4, 5, and 6 has been some kind of apocalyptic kind of weapon going off. And
yeah, it can no longer be
one
small
was,
scale.
One was still like the knock list, which was the entire database of IMF agents.
But
still, not the whole world was going to die.
Exactly. What do we think of Mission Impossible 3?
I really like it. It's my second favorite after 1.
Okay.
And this would be my number 3. Fallout would be number 3.
I think The Rabbit's Foot was too nondescript. I think Philip Hoffman, as good as he is, needed a better character, as did Billy Crudup. The running sequence at the end was quite entertaining, as was the low-altitude parachute jump. I like the sequence on the bridge, but I think it's a bit of a letdown in terms of the whole
series. I do,
too.
I think Philip Seymour Hoffman brought so much, you know, real evil
gravitas
to his villain. But, you know, this is a bit of an easy... criticism of J.J. Abrams making his directorial feature debut, but it feels very television, you know, like it's very plot-driven and talky, his twist.
So the IMF are not these cloak and dagger group. We live in Virginia. They're part of the Department of Transport. We know who they are now.
Yeah,
there's no mystique.
No one can decide what the IMF is over the course of this series.
Yeah, it was great in the first one where there was still this, you know, nondescript clandestine organization, and now it's just, Lawrence Fishburne runs them. Okay, sure.
I liked the shot that got used in all the trailers where the missile hits the car. No, the missile hits the bridge
and
Tom Cruise flies into the car.
That was
cool.
Great, though.
I thought the jump in Shanghai felt, you know, like too fake in CG. The series has really upped the scale of those kinds of diving or, you know, climbing
but
sequences.
Tom Cruise actually doing, including the amazing helicopter sequence in MI6.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
In that sense, like just to cap off Tom Cruise's like amazingness, actually, not just a progression of the series, but a progression of Tom Cruise as an actor. Or like, you know, star
having
personified.
Less and less important characters to play.
Yeah, yeah, but also like that he's actually stayed relevant.
To some degree. I think in order to stay relevant, he's really pushed himself into this I'm the incredible stuntman kind of thing. Because that
good on him. Good on him for doing
it. It's a way of keeping his star up in the air.
It's the last
number four. What do we think of Mission Impossible 4?
Number four.
It's funny.
Number four is
an action comedy.
I like Michael Nyquist in it. I found the Burj Khalifa sequence to be the series high. I found the whole Mission Accomplished bit to be a little too over the top.
The bit in Russia with the fake backdrop was fantastic.
Oh, that was hilarious.
I think it has... I liked how Brad Bird brought a lot of sprightly comedy to the action sequences. It made sense to do that after Mission Impossible 3, but again, you don't actually care that much about the actual characters or double crosses or the villain. No. Number five, I think, isn't really that remarkable outside
of the opera sequence.
I was about to say that. Yeah. The opera sequence is so good.
One
of the best actions. And so suspenseful. That was almost like something what De Palma would have done.
Yes.
Oh. And the ending was quite a good twist. Also when a head of state just dies and Europe doesn't seem to react at all, come
bizarre.
On. A little bit bizarre.
But let alone the Kremlin getting blown up in number four.
Not a big deal.
But Rogue Nation, I think, is a film that there's not much point in watching now. It just seems like a rough draft for Fallout.
I think
it's been totally superseded.
So we have to head off. Final views on Fallout. I think it's the series high since
the
first one.
I think you're right. Second best. Then I would go...
I'd recommend it in spite of what
Ghost
we said today.
Ghost Protocol in two, and then... 3 and 5? What about you?
Third best.
Five and three is the worst.
One, three, then six,
no.
Then
no,
two.
Two is probably, it's between two or three that's the worst, actually.
I would still say five is the worst. Five is the first worst by far.
No, I quite liked five.
It's unnecessary. I just feel
it is unnecessary, but like it was an entertainingly well-made action movie, I think. Especially
and
just because of the opera scene.
Going through the locales and Rebecca Ferguson, the most interesting character who's been introduced in four movies. I'd go...
Her dress was fantastic.
I'd go 1, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. So that is our Mission Impossible coverage. Mission Impossible 6 Fallout is in cinemas from tomorrow. The Korean
it's
Film
good.
Festival in Australia. It would recommend you see it.
I definitely recommend it. Like
all in agreement.
The action just... speaks for itself in this film.
It does. A lot of
listeners will find the criticisms we've been putting out petty nitpicking compared to the thrill the action scenes give you.
I'm going to watch it again.
Yeah, I am.
And the Korean Film Festival Australia is in cinemas from the next week, from the 8th of August. We'll be joining you next week from Myth. Thank you for subscribing to the podcast. This has been Glenn Fowkes, Chris Evans from Rotten Nehru. Enjoy movies. Enjoy your impossible missions if you choose to accept them.
We told you where we were going, so next week won't be a holiday for us. it's work. Accepted the mission of covering a film festival outside of our state.
We got these sunglasses and they told us to go and we just did it.
Yep.
We just was straight.
Yeah, and we paid for it too.
we unlike Tom Cruise,
we paid
though,
for Mission
I actually
Impossible too.
Badly burnt my hand because I threw the sunglasses just like a fraction
you're
of a second
to
too
do
late.
You're supposed to do quickly because they explode. Yeah. They give you a warning and it self-destructs.
I know, but you know, I tried to emulate Tom Cruise and you know how he holds onto them right until they're about to blow up and somehow it got away with it. I just don't have Cruise's luck.
Yeah, there is a lot of luck.
So what this,
and even acknowledge that.
The message that I've learned is don't try and do your own stunts. Tom Cruise. Leave it to Tom Cruise.
Do not try these stunts at home. Our biggest advice from this film. Yeah. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night.